Here we go.
Welcome to BP WrigleyCast. BP WrigleyCast is a Cubs podcast that looks at the game from both the analytical and the fans' point of view. This is episode 6, and before we get started, for those listeners that have heard our 5 previous episodes, you may have noticed that I always say, tonight we have a full crew, and that's because we know inevitably that we're probably not all going to be able to make all of these podcasts every single time, but we're having a blast right now, and I think that's why none of us wants to miss it, and we're all here again tonight. So I just want to thank all the listeners out there. We've gotten some great feedback, great reviews on iTunes. We appreciate it. Today is actually our 1 month anniversary since we started doing this. And looking at the numbers, we've had over 4,000 people listen to our episodes. So we appreciate it. We thank you. And let's keep it going. Happy anniversary, you guys.
Thanks, Carlos. That's so sweet.
Happy 1 month, guys.
Aww. Hugsies.
Okay, so let's get right into it.
Yes. Awkward.
let's stop talking about non-baseball things before we get all mushy here. Okay.
Stick to baseball.
Baseball Prospectus published the top 10 prospects for the Cubs last week, and I guess we call it Prospect Day. That's where we wanted to start today. So, Joel, anything that jumped out at you from this list? Anything that you wanted to discuss?
Well, nothing. I mean, it wasn't that surprising. I guess a couple things. You know, I wanted to ask you guys, like, who on this list, like, you know, Torres doesn't surprise me, Contreras doesn't surprise me, Hap, McKinney. I'm wondering two things. Number one, I'm a little surprised to see Billy McKinney that high, because I think the consensus is that he's got a great hit tool and is a solid player, but kind of a guy without a position, in the sense that he's a corner outfielder but doesn't have a lot of power. So I was a little surprised to see him so high, but I know everyone just says he's just got this preternatural ability to put the bat on the ball. But I also want to ask you guys, like, who on this list, like, really gets you excited? You're like, wow, I can't wait to see that guy. Because before it was, you know, when it was maybe Addison Russell or Bryant, you know, or Rizzo before he came up, I was so jacked to see those guys. So I'm wondering who you guys see on this list as someone you really can't wait to see at Wrigley. For me, it's Dylan Cease, but as a pitcher, and then after what we saw last night with Contreras, I think that really opened some people's eyes, and so I'm pretty excited to see him too, because catcher is one of the positions that, you know, within the next year or two, there's going to be a little flexibility. So those are the kind of the names that I'm really excited to see. What about you guys?
Yeah, for me, it's the second guy that you mentioned there, and for a lot of different reasons, it's Wilson Contreras. I think the first reason for me is that there's a position opening for him, so we're not going to have to wait a long time, and we're not going to have to go through any awkward, does this guy deserve to start over that guy? Mm-hmm. Wilson Contreras can be the starter pretty much from day one once he comes up, which I expect in the latter half of this year. I think he'll get some starts. But what's exciting about Contreras is that he's still raw as a catcher defensively. You're seeing just the absurd athleticism come out, where you see him pick off Chase Utley on a play that wasn't a designed pickoff, but he just read the play and fired the ball down to first. So you're seeing some incredible raw talent when he can refine his game from a pitch calling standpoint, and just working with the pitchers. I think that the sky's the limit. I think people have underrated his hit tool as well. Nobody can get him out. Nobody could get him out last year. He only hit 8 home runs last year, but he slugged .478. So you're talking about a professional hitter and a guy that's showing freak athleticism behind the plate. So for me, it's Wilson Contreras.
My guy is Eloy Jimenez. I really like him. And he's only, I want to say, 19 years old still. I mean, the guy is just a monster. He's listed at like 6'4", but he might be even taller than that. I remember when they first signed him when he was 17 years old, seeing a picture of him standing next to Manny Ramirez, and he made Manny Ramirez look tiny. He's just, like, huge and ripped, and, I mean, he's just a really good hitter. I don't know, he just screams, like, the ultimate prospect to me. Like, he's 19, but he can put the bat on the ball. He's going to be a quality right fielder, I think. or at least average. I don't know. I really like him. I like the power potential. I've fallen in love with power with all the prospects the Cubs have been throwing out there. So that's the guy that gets me excited on the list, other than the guys you mentioned who are also, you know, pretty exciting, I think.
For me, the couple guys that I to answer that question of can't wait to see, Dylan Cease, and mostly by virtue of him being a pitcher, right. I just want to see a pitcher. I want to see a pitcher that's on one of these lists come up and contribute in a meaningful way. You know, if it's the bullpen, you know, maybe it'll be Carl Edwards, who's at the bottom of this list at number 10. But I want to see a starter go in there and contribute and become, you know, a force out of the rotation. I think we're so used to, we're probably spoiled now having all these position prospects come up and just be studs. But that's who I want to see. I want to see a pitcher contribute, and we'll see what happens there. As for somebody that surprises me, I don't know about you guys, but I thought Ian Happ surprised me at number 3. Mm-hmm. I know he's got the versatility, but and the bat, he just kind of reminded me a little bit of even Billy McKinney, you know, even though he was drafted after him, but an okay bat that could play a corner outfield. You know, Happ can play second too, but I don't know. I was a little surprised that he's that high up on the list.
Well, I think, Carlos, two things about what you just said. Number one, I mean, I totally agree with you about Cease. And what's so exciting to me is that everyone says this is, you've heard all these other names, but you never hear top of the rotation guy. You hear like, you know, a 3 or a 4, and, you know, whether it's, you know, Pierce Johnson or, you know, Carson Sands, whatever. You hear these guys, and I never hear like stud. But Dylan Cease, I think he's hit 100. In the minors, and you know, so it's, I'm excited about that, and I'm excited to kind of put the meatballs to rest. We're like, oh yeah, but you know, Theo, where's the pitchers there? That was kind of, I was trying to do a Chicago, but it became a Wisconsin accent. I kind of lost it there.
It sounded prison to me.
I apologize. Well, that's, you know, your own experience there. Ian Happ, I think the thing is that people are excited about him is that he's got a good hit tool and he's a second baseman. That, to me, I've heard maybe a little versatility, but they're starting him at second now, and I think that's where they see him. So I think that if you get that position with a good bat, then that's why, maybe that's why he's put so high. That, I have to say, I agree, though, that does surprise me a little bit that he's number 3.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure if Happ can be a second baseman, but he could probably at least be like a left fielder or right fielder, possibly even center field if everything just goes right, but definitely at least a corner outfielder with a good bat. So I think the thing about Happ is there's probably a high floor but a low ceiling. Is that kind of fair to say about him?
Yeah, I think that's what I've heard.
Interesting thing is, I think, Carlos, you mentioned Carl Edwards Jr. when he talked about Dylan Cease. Cease has a very similar build to Carl Edwards. I want to say he has maybe a couple more pounds on him and is a couple inches shorter, but I want to say he's like 170 pounds and 6'1" or something like that. Do we have the same kind of concerns about him that we have about Carl Edwards, or do we think maybe, you know, he's going to be able to put the meat on his frame like Edwards never has been able to do?
I think you have to have some concern. I mean, he's already had surgery, so he's already had Tommy John, so I think the concern has to be there. I did read that he's made quite a few tweaks to his delivery to really quiet his motion and stop the kind of the glove side whip of his arm. His whip was pretty bad, where he would actually smack his own like left leg on his follow through. It's not a good sign. So I do think, Ryan, that you have to be concerned about him, but they do rave about his athleticism and just his projection on his frame, so they think he'll get quite a bit bigger. He's 6'1". So he could maybe put on some weight, but I look at Dylan Cease as probably a guy that's a late-inning bullpen guy, most likely. I don't want to say that he can't be a starter right now, but I think he looks like a guy that could be just absolutely dominant at the back end of a bullpen.
That's fair. And I wanted to mention this, too, about Cease before we go too much further, that I've followed John Arguello at Cubs Den, and I think all you guys do, too, but he lives out in Arizona and goes out to the fields out there and watches like a lot of the prospects play when spring training rolls around. And he was saying things like, Cease was snapping off this amazing curveball like he had only seen from the guy like maybe a couple times before that, and he threw like several of them during the time that he was out there throwing. So
very exciting.
That is very exciting to hear.
Yeah, I think sorry, Joel, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm surprised to hear you guys talking about him in the bullpen because I had heard him as starter with one or two potential.
Well, he definitely has the stuff to be a starter, but I just look at a guy that, you know, was 18 years old and already had Tommy John, and I just feel like the odds are maybe somewhat low. I don't think it's a question of stuff. Like you said, he's touching 100, and his curveball is disgusting, so it's kind of developing and maintaining that third pitch that could make him that, but it just remains to be seen. He's still so young, so it's, can he build up the ability to, you know, carry 160 to 200 innings in a year? And I think the odds are probably against it, though I would never place that on him today.
Well, beyond the top 10, Isaac did a nice recap on BP Wrigleyville, kind of bringing together the opinions of the different writers on the site to see who are the next five. And, you know, we can talk a little bit more about the guys on that list, but at number 12 came in Jamer Candelario, and I know that's somebody that we wanted to touch on a little bit today. He went 3-for-4 with a home run today. Isaac, what do you think about Jamer?
You know what struck me about Candelario is that his home run from today was from the left side, and there wasn't any great video on it because the game wasn't televised, but I got a fan shot of it. It looked like a pitch that was kind of low and outside that he more or less just threw his hands at and hit it out the opposite way down the line and left. It's the type of home run that there's not that many people in the world that are capable of doing that. It's impressive. But then if you go back to his home run 2 days ago that he hit, he was hitting right-handed, and it was a high inside, I think it was a high inside fastball if I remember correctly, and it was just a prototypical shot, just crushed it, majestic home run to left field. So you look at a guy from the right side and the left side, and he's got easy power both ways. The glove sounds like it's starting to come around, sounds like his hands are considered good enough, and if his range can get there, he could be a major league third baseman. So it's getting more and more exciting for Candelario, and next year at this time, it might look pretty silly that we actually had him as low as 12th in the system. I know Ryan's got some pretty serious thoughts on Candelario.
Yeah, I do. I saw him briefly when I was out in Arizona last week, and I've seen him on TV a couple times, and I've just been really impressed by his eye at the plate. He's laying off the bad pitches and going after the ones in the zone, even if he's not driving them or hitting them in play. I've seen him foul off some good pitches in the zone. He's making really good contact and showing off a really great batting eye. So I don't know. He's going to AAA this season, right? I don't see any reason. I mean, just thinking about positionally, guys who can play several positions, if you had said 3 weeks ago who's the first guy to come up if there's a positional injury at one of the corner spots, either outfield or infield, I would have said Christian Villanueva. Now, if Rizzo or Bryant or one of the corner outfielders has to, you know, take some time on the DL for something, I think Candelario is the first guy up.
You know, you touched on it there, and I actually meant to touch on this earlier too, but last season at Tennessee, I think he played 46 games there, and he walked more than he struck out for the first time.
Yeah, I saw that.
Oh, I love that.
That is pretty amazing. Yeah.
So he walked 22 times, and he struck out 21 times, and the power's there, and if he maintains that discipline, like Ryan just said, it could be huge. And unfortunately, the injury to Villanueva does really open the door for him to be that first guy up if we need it.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about Candelario, I feel like, because he's been around for so long and signing it at 17 years old, it's one of those names that, because I've heard it so long for so many years, I just kind of put him in the back of my mind and really didn't pay much attention to him. But he's really come far over the past year, and to get to number 12 on this list, I think it's a big step for him.
It is, yeah, it is. And, you know, he had the one blip in his career where I think at 19 years old, they tried to promote him to high A, Daytona at the time, and he really, really struggled, and they sent him back down to A. And I think when they demoted him back to A at the time is when he really fell off the prospect radars, mine included, because I'd been following him, and I was excited about him, and then I was like, okay, this kid's done. And then, you know, he progressed through it, and Theo always talks about getting through adversity, and it definitely seems like he got through it, and he really just exploded onto the scene at Tennessee last year.
Yeah, and I think he also had a really great winter ball. I talked to some people in Arizona who said that they were really impressed by him this last winter, and I think that's when he really started popping back up and on kind of the, I guess, the national scene, the more noticeable scene for Cubs hitting prospects. And then, again, in spring training, I mean, he's been in the lineup. Obviously, Madden only usually puts a few of the regulars in early on, so he's been in the lineup pretty frequently, but he's been in the middle of just about everything, and it's not just running into, you know, A-ball pitchers in the late innings putting up big stats. It's been early on against Eric Johnson and a few others that he's really gotten to. I think he's shown off a real ability to hit in the major leagues.
So, you know, you mentioned Ryan. I want to hear more about Ryan's trip to Arizona.
Yeah, I'll talk about Arizona a little bit. So I went down there as kind of a sort of a business trip, business slash pleasure, I guess. And I went to Sloan Park one time, met up with John Arguello, who I mentioned earlier, got some tickets from a guy from World Series Dreaming, named Jesse, real nice guy, and met up with a few other people. Just had a really good time and got to see the park for the first time. So that was pretty cool. As far as the game, you know, they were playing the Royals. I saw one of Addison Russell's home runs. Nothing too much to speak of there, but it was a really good experience getting out to the ballpark for the first time because I'd never been to spring training. Outside of the Cubs, I was credentialed to go into the Brewers clubhouse and meet with some of the players there and did a couple articles for another site. And one of them was a really good thing that I did with Matt Garza, where he answered a whole bunch of questions for me. And just in general, I spoke to a whole bunch of the Brewers' young players about what's going on this year with the clubhouse and their team. And they talked a lot about really cool things like how they're all, you know, staying connected is their big thing. And they're in the rebuild process like the Cubs were several years ago. And they're at the point where they're trying to rebuild the atmosphere in the clubhouse like the Cubs did, I think, with Rick Renteria. And I don't know, I see they have some really good prospects in the younger, like the lower levels, but I see a lot of really good things going on in there just based on what the players were saying about, you know, the kind of things that they're trying to do. Like,
I'm curious, Ryan, what kind of intensity level did you sense, like being there and seeing these guys, you know, still being 3 weeks away from baseball games that count? Was there an intensity level?
No, it was really relaxed. Like all those young kids, like especially like the younger prospects who have never really done anything before, like they're focused but they're relaxed. Like there was almost like this air of like they felt like they belonged there already, and it wasn't like an arrogant kids kind of thing. It was more like they had a kind of a swagger to them, like they knew they needed to work hard to get there, but they already felt like being in the room, you know, the veterans treated them like these are the kids of the future. It's kind of like a parallel to how the Cubs were 2 or 3 years ago. It really did feel like these kids really, you know, they know they belong. They know they're going to be there either this year or next year. As far as interesting stories go, I'll tell this one. It was my first time in a major league clubhouse, and I was escorted in, and I was fumbling around. I had my audio recorder and my little notebook that I wrote down, like, a whole bunch of questions for, like, 6 or 7 different players. And I was in there at 8 a.m., so I knew not everybody was going to be there. And I'm looking at my notebook trying to find what I'm looking for. And when I look up, I get my introduction to Major League Clubhouse, a very large baseball player, butt naked directly in front of me, like butt right in my face. Nice. Welcome to the major leagues.
So you felt right at home, right?
Yeah, it was just like walking around in my own home. The second introduction to reporting on a game or reporting in a clubhouse was those 6 or 7 players that I wrote down like 10 questions for each. None of them were in the clubhouse. Not a single one.
Did you get Garza to reflect on his time with the Cubs at all, or did he just kind of give you boilerplate, oh, it's great, great bunch of guys, I hope they do well, blah, blah, blah?
Yeah, I sensed that that's maybe what I would get from him on the Cubs, so I stayed away from that. I wanted to ask him more pertinent stuff about what happened with him last year, where he, you know, the big story was that he refused to go to the bullpen and instead just went home in September. But he had a wife that was pregnant with twins and I guess was bedridden at that point. So
I never heard that.
Yeah, I got him to open up a little bit about that and talk about the fact that it wasn't exactly like he refused to go to the bullpen as much as it was, you know, at that point in the season. They were going to send him to the bullpen and his wife was bedridden, so he just made the decision to go home because he felt like that was the right thing to do. And outside of that, I got him to say a lot of good things. The other interesting thing was those comments that Jonathan Lucroy made maybe a month or so ago. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
Where he said, basically, he honestly said he didn't see winning as the foreseeable future in Milwaukee. I asked Garza what he thought of that, and I saw it in his eyes when I said it. He hadn't heard that yet.
Oh.
And if you know Garza's rumored personality, the look he gave me when I was telling him that, I thought he was going to rip my face off. Because he did not agree with the sentiment of Jonathan Lucroy that this team cannot win.
I mean, I do.
Yeah, I agree.
Most people do, you know. But
yeah, Garza is an interesting breed. Everything he told me, I asked him what he thought the realistic expectations were this year for the Brewers, and he said every year he expects to get to October. And when
I guess you have to do spring training.
Yeah, I mean, when he said it, I believed it. You know, he didn't seem phony about it at all. He legitimately thinks the goal every year is to get to October.
Well, that's definitely the goal, but that's
maybe
not much more for him.
Maybe that's what you should have said, Ryan. Yeah, well, that's definitely
yeah. Listen, goal. Let's be realistic here, Matt. Come on,
kumbaya. Yeah. Let's finish with kumbaya.
Yeah, Garza was definitely the most high-profile player I got to speak to. So on my first trip into the clubhouse, I decided I wasn't going to try and incite any large riots or end up upside down in a garbage can or anything. So
next year we got to get one of us to cover the Cubs for spring training. How about that?
That sounds like a plan.
I volunteer.
That's the goal anyway.
Yeah.
No, Joel can't go. He'd be out there talking about, like, you know, Corey Patterson and David
Kelly. They'd escort me off.
Yeah. Everybody, nobody wants to hear about.
That was a good one. David Kelton.
I guess speaking of spring training, we need to talk about Mr. Hendricks, eh?
Yeah. Pretty good game today, right?
Another four innings, one hit, no runs. I think that's, what is that, 10 innings
ten,
now?
10 strikeouts, I think.
Yeah, I think he's got 9 innings, and last I saw he had 10 strikeouts. If he struck out any in that fourth inning, that would be more. But I think 9 innings, one earned run total is what he's thrown out there, and 10 strikeouts, so.
You know, we talked about him, and I know Pecota is high on him, and I'm wondering, what do you guys see as his ceiling?
Well, if you look at Pecota's percentiles, his 90th percentile is 3.3 warp. I guess that's probably his ceiling, but I can actually see a little bit more there. This is a guy that has to be taken seriously now. I mean, he transformed himself into a guy that was, his K9 was about 5 to over 8 last year. In 1 year, he went from 5.3 to 8.3. He was a 2.5 warp pitcher last year, which is about 31st among starting pitchers. So he's got to be taken seriously. And, I chatting with you guys earlier, I think one of you said, so the rotation battle's over, right? And I think it is. I think he is your fifth starter, and it's time to really see what he can do over the course of the season.
Yeah, I think that was probably me, and I wrote something earlier this week on the site about how I don't really believe there ever was a real rotation battle, but you know, we could get into that more if we wanted to. But yeah, I just kind of looked it up. It's 9 innings, 11 strikeouts, a 0.67 whip, and one earned run for Hendricks so far this spring. So yeah, I completely agree with you. I think Warren definitely has a really good potential future. The Cubs told him when they acquired him it was for him to be a starter eventually, maybe not right away. And I think that's more with an eye on Hamill being gone after this year, or Lackey, or injuries, or whatever. I don't think that was ever with the intention of replacing Hendricks, barring something blowing up on him. But yeah, I think as far as I'm concerned, Hendricks is absolutely in the rotation unless he gets hurt.
Well, what about the fact that Madden just didn't seem to have a lot of confidence going long later in the season? Is that, do you think that's just a small sample size? You know, part of me wonders sometimes if Madden with Hendricks and Hamill was doing kind of a, you know, the way Phil Jackson used to get on Horace Grant all the time to get more out of him. Like some players respond to, you know, that kind of antagonism almost, and some wilt. Like Tony Kukoc, I think, you know, to stay on basketball, which to me, I think we should shift the focus to basketball.
Talk about the 90s Bulls. Out of the 90s Cubs, that's a much better idea.
But he, like Tony Kukoc would have wilted, for instance. So I wonder if maybe Madden. I mean, this the answer is probably this is wrong. But I'm just wondering if there was some element of him trying to, you know, make him improve by, you know, saying your stuff isn't good enough, maybe yet. And so Hendricks would, you know, work to improve to prove him wrong.
Well, it kind of ties into a tweet that you posted, Isaac, on Hendricks and kind of rethinking, is he a strikeout pitcher? I don't know if you were, what level of humor you were going for in that tweet, but he's striking out a lot of guys. I mean, does that tie into, if he was more of a strikeout pitcher, would Madden be more comfortable leaving him in?
I really didn't mean it with any levity at all, actually. I think people miss the fact that he struck out 8.5 guys per nine last year. I just think they're completely overlooking that when they're analyzing Kyle Hendricks. What I look at is whether or not he can get that walk rate back below 2 per nine. If he can stay in that 8-9 strikeout ratio, he's got the devastating changeup. It's an elite pitch. If he can get his walks under 2 per nine, I mean, you're looking at a solid middle of the rotation guy that will be our fifth starter. So I think he genuinely is a guy that can sustain that K9 around 8 or maybe a little above.
More to Joel's point, I don't know if it was necessarily that Madden was doing the tough love thing on him like Phil Jackson did to Horace Grant that worked with him, although he also did it to Tony Kukoc and it was terrible for Kukoc. But anyway, yeah. I don't think that's necessarily what it was. I think it was that it was the heart of a pennant race. The Cubs had really thin rotation depth, and they were relying on a guy who was essentially a rookie. I mean, he pitched half a season the year before, but this was his real baptism into Major League Baseball, pitching in a pennant race in September as a first full-year pitcher. So I think Madden was actually kind of babying him and giving him – I mean, he struggled early on with that third time through the order. Everyone knows about that.
Yeah.
I think he was relying more heavily on a bullpen that had an extra guy in it basically all year and had guys like Travis Wood and Trevor Cahill who could go multiple innings. I think he was using that to his advantage to get through the season and you know, kind of helping Kyle Hendricks. I mean, there's no harm in a young pitcher who's basically, he's not going to rely on blowing guys away, putting the training wheels on for the first year and, yeah, having him learn. I think that's what they were doing.
I think one more point on Hendricks, just to make real quick, is we only had three starters last year because you had Hendricks at the four at that point in the year is what I'm saying. You had Hendricks at the four, and then you had Dan Heron or whomever else you were running out there at the five. So I think what Joe Madden was doing is, one, as Ryan said, he was trying to win every game he could, and two, he was trying to preserve Hendricks for the playoffs because he knew at that point that he only had, you know, basically 2.5 starters, and he needed Hendricks, so he was trying to limit his innings so he was more fresh for the playoffs. It didn't really work, but I think that's what he was trying to do.
Yeah, that's what I think it really was, especially because he knew that he was going to have to rely on him for the playoffs, like you said. Heron was actually pitching pretty well down the stretch, but the Cubs, they seemed to be pretty set with Heron not being on the postseason roster. I think that maybe was a decision that was set pretty far in advance. So, yeah, I think that's really the narrow way to break it down is, you know, they were preparing him to make sure that he was still had a fresh arm, that they didn't just completely wear him out, and to, you know, keep his confidence up. Because if you're going to let him go out there and go into sixth or seventh inning after basically dominating the first few innings and then get blown up every single time, I think he might start getting in his own head a little bit, and I'm pretty sure Madden really just wanted to keep him away from doing that to himself.
Yeah, I think Carlos made a good point, too, with his age. He's 26, and doesn't have a lot of experience. So, I mean, he's the kind of guy who obviously is, he's not exactly Randy Johnson with the fastball, but he's a true kind of quintessential pitcher, you know, and he's obviously smart, went to Dartmouth, which is, I feel morally obligated to mention that every time his name comes up. I think that's one of those things that people always throw out there.
Yeah, but, you mentioned that on the last podcast too,
I just want to keep my track record clean on that.
Did he go to Dartmouth, Joel?
I thought we just talked about that.
It's in Hanover.
But I think that I don't know. The arrow is pointing up, and I think it's great. And Hamill too. These past two seasons. I mean, it's funny because I saw this on a different site. People saying, you know, it's like, oh well, Lester has not been that impressive so far in the preseason. Although I think he's pitched like what, one game, and whereas Arrieta was, you know, Cy Young all over again. And it's like on the one hand, it's like, I know that the games don't count and it's completely irrelevant, but it's like, it's a little convenient to be like, oh, well, look, Hendricks is doing great and Hamill's doing great and Arrieta's doing great. And Lester sucked, but it doesn't matter. It's like, well, do you see what I mean? It's like a little bit of a double standard, but I know that the bottom line is it doesn't matter. But my point was, the bigger point I was getting to is that, you know, you've got the top three you feel comfortable with. If Hamill and Hendricks can get close to what we think they can do, then that's a really strong 1-5. That's not a 1-3 and cross your fingers. I mean, that's a strong 1-5.
Well, one thing I was going to say is I think it's one of the things that comes with these pitchers that can't throw 95 miles an hour. People automatically have these assumptions about them. But as Isaac mentioned, he has an elite pitch, which is rare, and that even if that pitch is a changeup, it's still an elite pitch, and that's, you can see how he can generate these strikeouts with a pitch like that.
Yeah, and you know, when your changeup's like 38 miles an hour, it's almost an Ephus pitch, so he's got that going for him.
Oh, boo, that's not nice.
Low hanging, sorry.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's hop into our segment for this week. This, I believe it was Joel's idea, but it goes like this. We're each going to go around and pick our player to fill in this blank. If something stands in the way of the Cubs making the World Series this year, it's blank. And it actually doesn't need to be a player or specifically. Yeah. So Joel, you came up with this idea. Why don't you go first?
Yeah, I was looking at the team, and I am really bullish on this. I mean, everyone is, but I've told people, I'm like, I really, really believe this is the year. But the one thing that makes me break out in a cold sweat and not in a good James Brown way is the New York Mets pitching staff. And the thought of going up against Harvey and Syndergaard, especially him, and DeGrom, I mean, those guys just freaked me out. And they freaked out the hitters, too. The lineup looked so ineffectual against them. And what the Cubs had specialized in all year was working the counts and making guys, they're into the, 80 pitches by the fourth inning, making the pitchers work, and they were not able to do that against the Mets for some reason. I know that they're young, and maybe it was, you know, the pressure, but they just couldn't do it. They just couldn't touch these guys, and they scored 8 runs in 4 innings against them, and it just, I know all the caveats. I mean, I know that Murphy went, had a career streak, and that he's gone, and that won't happen again, and the odds of a team getting to the series again are, I mean, I know all of the caveats, but still, they freak me out, and the thought of facing them again in the playoffs just really doesn't fill me with confidence.
I think Ryan needs to go next.
Yeah, Joel, you're a jerk. We talked about this.
I didn't see that.
To fill in the listeners, where Carlos in our Slack conversation said, let's throw out there what we're each going to say so that we don't all say injuries or something like that. And I said, I think verbatim, I'm taking the Mets pitching staff.
I didn't see that. I totally didn't see that.
Guys, we're all in spring training mode, so we're allowed to mess up.
Because I thought I said that. Well, all right. I apologize. I did not see that.
Joel.
They call me the podcast ruiner.
Did you know that every single one of the starters in the Mets rotation went to Dartmouth?
See? It all comes full circle.
Joel's going to get off the podcast and open his locker and find a red tag hanging there.
I don't know what that means, but it sounds ominous.
It's a major league reference. Sorry.
I thought it's better than like a horse's head in my bed. I thought that's what you were going to say.
All right. Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah, mine, I guess, Billy Goat curses then. Isaac, your turn.
Sorry about that. I apologize.
Wow. We now know that Ryan needs to be prepared. My kryptonite for the Mets starting pitching is the fact that we've completely re-engineered our lineup to be severely left-handed if we wanted it to be. So you've got Zobrist, Hayward, Schwarber, Rizzo, Fowler, the Montero, the lefties go on and on. So I think that we can overcome the Mets pitching much, much better this year. So I think if there's something that's going to keep us out of the World Series beyond our own very excellent division, I'll just say the NL West. The Dodgers are a really, really deep team, and I think people are maybe sleeping on them a little bit. I will say that with the Dodgers, I hated what they did with their pitching. I thought that they threw a bunch of money at a bunch of question marks, and they probably should have just retained the services of Zach Greinke while they had the chance. But they're really good. I really liked the offseason that the Giants had. I thought they got pretty good value out of the starting pitching. They lost a whole bunch of starting pitching, and it was all really bad. Like the Denard Span edition. So the Giants are always dangerous. I think they're going to sneak up on people. I really like their rotation this year. It's deep. Their bullpen is still very, very good at the back. I think Span helps that offense quite a bit. Hunter Pence will be healthy. Buster Posey is one of the best players in the game. So I think you could see a step up from Brandon Belt. So I think the Giants and the Dodgers pose the biggest threat to keep us out of the World Series.
You know, you're talking about the Giants pitching. Cueto and Samardzija, I mean, those are two guys. Do they really strike fear in you?
I don't know about fear, Joel, but Cueto's a solid starter. He's going to be good. He's an innings eater. And then I think Samardzija will bounce back. The stuff was still there, so I think his season last year was a bit of an aberration. So, I mean, I look at their rotation, and top to bottom, I'd say it's one of the better ones, and their offense is very sneaky good. It's kind of right. Cardinals good, where they're all above average, and you got mm-hmm. one superstar. So I just think they're a very solid team without any holes.
They have the potential to strike fear.
Yeah, well, three World Series rings. That is a pretty impressive track record too. So
I'll chime in with my answer on this question, and it's going to be the most unsatisfying answer of them all. And it's just baseball. You know, things happen. You can make every single move correctly. The players can go out there and perform to expectations, above expectations. And sometimes you just have a bad series or bad luck. And so that's what I'm going to go with for this answer, because I think a lot of people forget, you know, when we get caught up in the fever of, you know, what's going to happen? How are we going to get past the Mets starting rotation? What are we going to do? Are we going to pull off the right moves? And sometimes you do everything the way you're supposed to, and it just doesn't work out. So that to me is the biggest obstacle between the Cubs and the World Series this year.
For what it's worth, on the BP Wrigleycast Twitter account at BP Wrigleycast, I tweeted out, if the Cubs aren't in the World Series this year, which National League team is? And the options I gave were the Cardinals, the Mets, the Giants, or as a compilation, Washington, the Dodgers, the Pirates, or other. And with 37% of the vote, the Washington, Dodgers, Pirates, or other got, they just edged out the Giants, who came in at 36%. And the Mets came in at 23%, and the Cardinals with just 4% of the vote, which tells you a lot about the people voting. But we got 188 votes on that poll, thanks to BP Wrigleyville tweeting that out. So, if that tells you anything about the way the Cubs fans are thinking right now, most scared about anyone but the Mets and the Cardinals.
Why? How can people not be terrified of the Mets? I don't get that. I mean, I feel like maybe I'm, you know, it's like someone who's afraid of flying. It's irrational, but just like Syndergaard just completely wigs me out.
I think you're probably just kind of, I don't know, what, are you attracted to him? Is that, are you just nervous? Is this like a school dance type of thing, Joel?
Yes.
Maybe.
Yeah, to round that point out, I just don't think the Mets' offense is any good. I mean, their offense was pathetic until the All-Star break, and then they caught some sort of crazy fire. They traded for Cespedes, and he was way better than he actually is. And, you know, Daniel Murphy suddenly became Ted Williams in the playoffs. And it is a bit of a fluke. I mean, their rotation is excellent, but I still think their offense is probably below average in the National League.
Well, Joel, I can see your point about being afraid of the Mets, especially because of the rotation. So, if like, I have a question for you guys. If we had to trade for one of the guys in the Mets rotation, which pitcher would you go after?
Syndergaard.
Yeah, that's where I'd go to.
Yeah, Syndergaard probably.
Okay.
Are we thinking just based on which pitcher would you like to have, or are we considering, you know, which one costs the most prospect?
No, just whoever you want.
I figure Matt Harvey comes the cheapest, right?
Yeah, he's kind of the problem child, right?
Yeah.
He's like the Ryan Braun of New York.
I thought you were going to say the Ryan Davis of...
He's the Ryan Davis of the Mets.
He's the Ryan Davis of the Brewers clubhouse.
Like, we kind of have to have him, but we don't really want him.
Yeah, exactly. That's 100%.
Snap.
Okay, Joel. Who are we traveling back in time with this week?
This is for the 60 seconds with the former Cub. This is Bill Miller, former third baseman who played for the Cubs for part of 2001-2002 seasons. So, man, it's hard to do this in just a minute, but, you know, I'm gonna give it a go.
You'll find a way.
Try to make it intelligible. give me the start, and I will go for it.
Ready? Go.
Hopes weren't exactly sky high when the Cubs traded middling reliever Tim Worrell to the San Francisco Giants for third baseman Bill Miller. But nabbing Miller quickly proved to be one of Jim Hendry's savvier moves. Miller was a deft fielder and a strong hitter, with 5 homers and an OBP north of 400 in his first 36 games of 2001. Then on May 13th, he injured his knee in a freak collision with the wall and, of course, St. Louis, I'm sure it was intentional on their part, fracturing his left kneecap and tearing a muscle in his leg. He tried to come back later in the season, but he was clearly not the same player. The Cubs foolishly traded him back to the Giants 2/3 of the way through the next season for the immortal Jeff Verplank, and Miller then signed with the Red Sox in 2003. That's the year he won the batting title with an average of .326. He won a ring the following year, hitting the crucial single in Game 4 of the ALCS to knock in Dave Roberts in the ninth inning. Miller retired and joined the Cubs as a hitting coach in 2014, which seemed like a great fit, but he left after 1 year as now the assistant hitting coach for the hated St. Louis Cardinals.
Oh, 1 minute. Finish it up.
That's it. Hated St. Louis Cardinals.
Hated St. Louis Cardinals.
That's, I think we need to add the word hated every time we say St. Louis, just even in passing. Like, oh, I drove through the hated town of St. Louis. Something
like that. I live pretty close to St. Louis, so I can completely concur with this idea.
I've actually never been there.
Are you kidding me?
That explains why you're so happy-go-lucky.
That explains why you can talk about horrible things without having, you know, bad thoughts.
But does it really, like, affect your soul so profoundly? It's like you gaze into the abyss if you go into St. Louis.
All right, so I live very close to St. Louis, like about an hour and 15 minutes. And I went to the first game a couple years ago of the Blues and Blackhawks in the playoffs. In that playoff series, I think the Blackhawks went down 0-2 and then came back and won, and then won the Stanley Cup. But I had to leave after a 2-overtime loss in Game 1 wearing all my Blackhawks stuff. And Blues fans, I'm going to keep this, you know, from getting the explicit tag, but Blues fans were pretty terrible human beings as we were trying to just, you know, my wife and I hold hands and walk to our car. Mm-hmm. So that's just a snapshot for me of what St. Louis is. I mean, the joke about the best fans in baseball thing, I take very to heart. Because, yeah, that's my sort of experience in St. Louis, is a lot of those fans just act like a bunch of drunk jerks.
Well, I would like to say that all Cardinals fans are lovely, wonderful, just law-abiding citizens, because my lovely wife happens to be a supporter of the team in St. Louis, of which we do not speak.
Is she in the room, or she listens to the podcast?
Well, she's in the house somewhere, and I do have a healthy fear of her, so...
Well, they do hear everything you say.
They feel it. I think she feels it when I bash the Cardinals. Somewhere deep down, I just, you know, I lose a point on the checkboard. So
it's kind of like how you felt when Addison Russell hit those homers. You just felt it in your soul.
I think that's a different kind of feeling. We can talk about that offline.
Fair enough.
The one thing I want to say about Bill Miller is I remember when he came over to the Cubs, he had hit .268 the season before, and I think it was Don Baylor that said, either in spring training or throughout the course of the season, I think this guy is really good, and I think one day he'll win a batting title. And I remember hearing that and thinking, what? The highest he had hit was 292, 294, 290 with the Giants when he was 26, 27, 28. And I was like, oh, Don Baylor, what does he know? And then, lo and behold, 2003, he won the batting title.
I mean, I remember when they got him, I remember thinking, this guy, like, I had the opposite thought. I thought this guy is good, and they better hold on to him. And sure enough, he just seems so solid, and he's like such a smart player. And then when we were talking about this on Slack, Isaac mentioned they were in first place when he went down, and I checked to see if there was maybe some cause and effect there. But actually, the team stayed in first place for a couple more months after he went down in May. So. But I was really excited about him. I liked him a lot, and I was really disappointed that they traded him. I wasn't sure why they did that, but you know, he proved him wrong, and he had a couple good years with the Red Sox there, and then when he came back, and I was like, great, a great hitting coach, this will be perfect. And then he was only here for a year, and he was mad because they fired the assistant hitting coach, Mike Brumley. So I don't know, maybe he's like difficult, actually, and that's why he keeps getting traded, or maybe, I don't know what the deal is, but I, you know, was really disappointed when they traded him to the Giants, and I was disappointed when he did not stay longer as the hitting coach, because that seemed like a great fit.
Yeah, that's, Bill Miller is actually one of my earlier Cubs memories, because he was with the Cubs, it was 2001, right? Mm-hmm. That was the year that they held for first place, like, all year until September. I became a fan a few years before that, but that was one of my really great first Cubs seasons, I guess, as a fan, where I really, like, hung on every pitch every single day, and I knew all the players on the team, and I knew all the players in AAA, and I just felt like that was the year that sucked me in as a fan, and I thought he was the guy who was going to end the third base drought, where they just rotating players in at third base since Ron Santo. And he was like the perfect number two hitter to hit in front of Sammy Sosa, because the guy puts the bat on the ball, he gets on base. Of course, Baylor didn't bat him second, but he batted Ricky Gutierrez there so that he could bunt Eric Young from first to second.
Oh my goodness.
Even though Young was stealing like 60 bases a year that year. But yeah, I mean, that team had so many good players at positions that they just kind of patched together, and that they had like the rotation that completely overperformed, and they had Jeff Fassero having a career year. I mean, that was the team that made me fall in love with the Cubs, and I was pretty devastated when Bill Miller got hurt and then later traded. That was pretty rough.
Yeah, I have pleasant memories of Bill Miller as a player. I thought he was a really, really good hitter. I just loved watching him hit, a professional hitter. But my best memory of Bill Miller is listening to Ron, the aforementioned Ron Santo, try and pronounce his name every single day. Bill Mueller. Pat says, it's Miller, Ron. Oh, yeah, Bill Mueller. No chance.
And as a little bit of quick trivia before we move on, the player that had to pretty much take over every day at third base was Ron Coomer, who is now the Cubs play-by-play guy on the radio.
That's good trivia, Pat.
Yeah, and then we ushered in the Aramis Ramirez era.
Yeah, so that, you know, that worked out okay.
Yeah, that's really the saving grace of trading Bill Miller, is that they were contending in 2003 and basically needed a third baseman again, so they had to make the Ramirez trade.
Joel, that is how you focus on the positive. Just take some notes.
Okay. I will. Duly noted.
By the way, before we move on to the our Cubs question of the week from the fans, I've been doing some clicking around, and the GM of the New York Mets, Sandy Alderson, went to
Dartmouth. See? God, that's cool. I love it, and I hate it at the same time.
He also went to Harvard, so.
What, yeah. Did he go to Harvard for grad school or something?
Harvard and Harvard Law School. He's a smart man.
Hmm.
All right, Ryan, what do you got today? What question did we get from the fans?
All right, this one comes from Joshua Paul. His Twitter is @slapthefloor. I'm guessing that's some sort of college basketball thing. His question is, what metric or advanced stat is the most overused or overrated? And I know you guys have different opinions on this, or maybe different thoughts, but the one that I wanted to go with was basically a compilation. Any advanced defensive metric, I think, is the most overused or overrated. And to explain that a little better, I think defensive metrics are good for the game, and they're good that we're developing them and constantly trying to make them better to be able to measure, you know, how good a player is on defense, or like the range, or everything involved, because we all know that just fielding percentage and whether or not he makes errors is not necessarily a good predictor of whether he's a good defensive player. But defensive stats as they exist are somewhat inconsistent and can kind of, the way they show whether a player is great or not may not necessarily mesh with the eye test. And the best example I can come up with is Johnny Peralta of the Cardinals. Early on in his career, was kind of rated as a pretty poor defensive shortstop. He's very, you know, kind of thick in the lower half. He looks
generous.
He doesn't look like a shortstop. Let's say, he doesn't have great range. He can make plays on balls hit right at him, but
he's a really nice guy.
Yeah, and he spells his name in it. Early in his career, the Indians had him and tried to move him to third base because he was just not rated out well as a good defensive shortstop. He went to the Tigers and ended up moving back to shortstop. And then all of a sudden, like, he becomes this good defensive shortstop again by the metrics. And then he, to the point where pre-2014, he was actually rated as, like, the top defensive shortstop in Major League Baseball. Ahead of Anderson Simmons.
All right.
So, if that tells you anything about the volatility of defensive metrics and how they're just sort of an inconsistent bunch at this point, I mean, they're still being refined. So, when I see people using defensive metrics as kind of the end-all be-all about players, that's where I think those are overused or overrated.
Yeah, I mean, this question got me thinking about, because I agree with what you said about, you know, it's good that we're trying to quantify this and trying to make strides and get better. And the first thing I thought of when you said that was StatCast. And when that stuff becomes kind of more easily available for us to kind of pour through and look at, I think that'll be a huge step forward in kind of and looking at how players are good defensively or not. I think that'll be very interesting.
Yeah, and I think what Ryan just touched on, Joel's chatting me and basically giving me a hard time for not chiming in on this. I feel like I'm beating this horse so dead. But the same issues that you have with advanced defensive metrics are the same ones that I have with pitch framing, where I think it's nice that we're trying to quantify it. I just think we're a long ways from being able to do it effectively.
I mean, I was going to say, do you think it's possible to do? But I guess that, you know, because if you just think about it, like quantifying a shortstop's range, well, there's the so many variables that come into play. You know, the pitcher, the speed of the pitch, the quality of the infield, the wind. Like, there's just so. But I guess there are a lot of variables for hitting too. I just wonder, will they ever be able to quantify it to such a degree that they have hitting quantified to?
I think they will, and I think in talking about StatCast, like, I think of Albert Almora, you know, we keep hearing the same thing about him. Elite glove in center field. He's not the fastest guy, but his routes, he just seems to know where the ball is going, right? He has this innate ability to just get there. if we had him in the major leagues and we had StatCast data available to us to kind of pour through, we could see, well, where does he rank on, you know, speed to a ball? Is he middle of the pack like the eye tests is saying from the scouts? And is his efficiency, what's it called, efficiency rating, the efficiency of the route that he takes to the to a fly ball, like is that in the upper echelon of center fielders? That could kind of put some real meat behind the argument of the eye tests that have said what they said about him as a player.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great point on StatCast, Carlos, is that once we have that information more readily available, we'll be able to see all the information about, I mean, they'll be able to nail it down to the amount of time it takes off the bat before the player breaks to the spot. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I know they're already kind of keeping those stats and just kind of letting a little bit of it trickle out at, you know, here and there to see who's doing really well with that stat, but I know they have those little blue lines that they put on the route to the ball, and they can measure like exactly what the best route is on each ball and see how often the player, how often the player makes the correct route and how quickly the guys, you know, break to that route. I mean, it's really insane kind of stuff, especially for outfielders, which I think that is all the best for. But I tend to agree that eventually they're going to continue working at it and get to the point where defensive metrics are going to be very high quality. But as of right now, I think everyone should understand that defensive metrics are somewhat imperfect, and they can give you things like saying, because of the way defensive metrics are tied into WAR or WARP, they can give you a 5.5 WAR on Johnny Peralta, when he may not be the most valuable shortstop in Major League Baseball. It just looks that way because for some reason the defensive metrics think he's a better fielder than Andrelton Simmons.
That's a good point. So we're talking about stats. Isaac, what's our stat of the week?
Yeah, and actually Ryan just said it, and this plays well into this. The stat of the week is WARP, which is Baseball Prospectus's version of wins above replacement. It stands for wins above replacement player. So it's a calculation based on how well a player does against what is considered a replacement level player, which is a rather ambiguous term, but you can think of it like this. If there was a team filled with 25 replacement level players, they'd win just over 50 games. So it'd be a very bad 50, call it 50 and 110 team. A replacement player is defined as someone who is readily available in the minor leagues at all times. So think of it as your classic 4A player. So the shorthand here for WARP is how many wins a player is giving you via his bat, his glove, and his base running for hitters. How many wins they're giving you over this said 4A replacement level player. League leader last year was Bryce Harper with 11 wins. So he was generating 11 wins for his team above what a replacement level player would be. The Cubs leader, 11th overall in the majors, was Chris Bryant at just under 6 wins. So he was about 6 wins better than your replacement level player would be. So to Ryan's point, you do have to take it with a grain of salt because some of the defensive metrics that are worked into there, you know, there's some question about the validity of them, but it is an excellent shorthand to really understand the quality of one player's season versus another player's season.
It's kind of become the gold standard now. I mean, for people who aren't looking at, you know, batting average and pitching wins and losses, that's like, yeah, that's baseball nerd humor. Like, they're like, oh, he still looks at wins and losses. The meanest insult you can give someone.
It kind of has, Joel, but on the other hand, it's actually getting to the point where if you reference it in a certain way, people sort of deride you for using it too kind of holistically. You have to use your WARP calculations along with other stats to support why the player is, you know, gaining a certain number.
Yeah, the interesting thing to add on to that is, I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but Kyle Hendricks' WAR, I think, on FanGraphs placed him like the 23rd or 25th or something like that most valuable starting pitcher in baseball, which would have him essentially as a low-end number one starter. Now, nobody who watched him last year actually believes that anything he did looked like a low-end number one starter. I mean, we can go over all the things we said about him before, and basically the only thing you could say is, well, he strikes out a decent amount of guys and didn't walk a ton of people, but I think that's a really good example of whatever Fangraphs does with their WAR calculation. Really liked Kyle Hendricks last year, but there's no way he was, you know, one of the top 25 pitchers in Major League Baseball, or that you would at least take him over, you know, everyone but about 25 guys.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting. I don't want our robot overlords, as Carlos would call them, to get too mad at me, but I feel like there's kind of delineating factors between each one here. I feel like Fangraphs overrates certain metrics of starting pitching. I feel like WARP, Baseball Prospectus's, overrates pitch framing for catchers and kind of skews the numbers. And I feel like Baseball Reference overrates what Ryan was talking about, which is some of the defensive metrics, outfield defense especially. So they all definitely have their issues, but you kind of need to look at all three of them and combine and make an aggregate, and you can really get a good shorthand for how a player performed.
And kind of a final thought from me on that is, we're nitpicking at it because that was the question, which one is most overrated or overused, and that's kind of the way we went with this, but I think it all is really good because the people who are creating these stats are continually changing and looking and creating new things. I know Baseball Prospectus is doing that with Draw that just came out last year, and the way they've calculated WARP for pitchers has adjusted, and they're constantly trying to find ways to make it better. So I think it is working that way, but I think everybody has kind of an understanding that it's not perfect now, and it probably never will be perfect. It'll just continue improving.
Oh, that's you just closed with what should be our slogan for this podcast. We're not perfect, but we're continuously improving.
And we'll never be perfect.
I wish that was true. I'm not sure we're actually improving, but I appreciate your positivity, Carlos.
It balances so, and that's what really counts is we're trying.
Keep it positive.
1 month, guys. We've been at it for just 1 month, so let's keep going at it.
Yeah, Ryan says that I am the replacement level podcaster. So you know what? I'm going to go ahead and take that. That means I'm going to get a cup of coffee.
Yeah, I mean, you're the 4A podcaster of the group.
The Matt Caesar. That's how I look at it.
Oh, you know what? You made my day, Joel.
See, there you go. I'm all about smiles.
Joel, just to make Isaac angry, I'll say, Joel, you are the Addison Russell of our podcast.
You can expect me at your door any minute, Joel.
How long I've been waiting to hear you say those words.
Whoa.
Well, 2 seconds.
I think that's our cue.
Yeah, getting a little loose here.
Roll the music.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody out there. You can ask us questions, reach out, give us feedback on Twitter, BP Wrigleycast. You can also email us at bpwrigleycast@baseballprospectus.com. Send us your questions. Send us your thoughts. We love hearing from you. We are getting closer to real baseball games, so we're very excited, and we hope to have you along for the ride. All right. Good night, guys.
Thanks.
Good night.
See ya.
Later.